Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mary Sue Barrett, president of the Metropolitan Planning Council, and we're delighted to see about 200 of you joining us here for an early discussion of the potential for true gold standard bus rapid transit in Chicago. What an exciting day. What the Metropolitan Planning Council works on is making this city, this region, more competitive, more livable, more equitable. We've been doing that for 77 years. We're nonpartisan, an independent organization, and we partner with just about everyone we can think of. We're a complicated organization to understand because we work across a broad geography, pretty broad set of issues, and we work across lots of different sectors. But it all boils down to this. We connect the dots on bringing the issues and the people and the ideas together to get things done. So today's focus on bus rapid transit is right up our alley. Metropolitan Planning Council's mission is about building a more livable region. We believe that when you make tough investment decisions, both the public and the private sectors should assess how those investments will improve competitiveness and livability. Nowhere is that more true than in our transportation system, which is the backbone, the foundation of community revitalization and economic development. At the same time, our region suffers greatly under the pressures of traffic gridlock. Our research report of 2 years ago, Moving at the Speed of Congestion, documented that the costs were far higher than earlier thought. $7.3 billion annual costs to the metropolitan Chicago economy. That's about $3,000 per Chicagoan stuck in traffic, additional costs than you would otherwise have to spend. That's the congestion tax that you pay today for inefficiency. I think we can all come up with some better ways to invest those dollars. We see bus rapid transit as a great way to be part of the solutions to regional congestion busting, while also improving the livability of our region. Our vision for Chicago Bus Rapid Transit Network today is meant to accomplish three things. The report that you are receiving, number one, challenges and inspires city leaders, business owners, and residents to rethink what transit can mean for Chicago. Number two, the report is meant to test a theory about transit and livability. Hint, they're connected. Number three, the report is meant to pioneer a method for using livability as a screening criteria to make the tough investment decisions that we face, public and private sectors. There are just a bunch of people in the room that I would like to thank if I had a little bit more time. But since I don't, let me just give a shout out to a few agencies and institutions that have been so critical to getting to this point today. First of all, the data assistance that we received from the Chicago Transit Authority and from the Chicago Department of Transportation was invaluable. The demand modeling that the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning, or CMAP, made available to us enabled the work of the report. The Institute for Transportation and Development Policy, or ITDP, as you'll be hearing about today, was really helpful on research and unique insights from around the globe through their work. And AECOM, I know a number of you are here joining us here today from AECOM. Thank you for your support that allowed the printing and distribution of today's report. The Metropolitan Planning Council is fortunate to have both a talented staff and some amazing volunteers, board members, committee members, project volunteers. I want to give a special recognition to the quarterback of our BRT team, our Vice President Peter Scozzi, and part of that team included a number of folks that have already done a lot of work and will continue to do so. Josh Ellis, who you'll be hearing from on the panel, on the development of this method, so the crunching of the data. Chrissy Nichols, who is helping us already understand innovative financing tools and now will be a resource to those looking at how we might finance new infrastructure investments, such as including BRT. Joanna Trotter, who runs our community building initiative and will be assisting us as we continue to build on today in community outreach. Josh Anderson, who was a research assistant at the time of the study, we also are grateful for. He's now with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District. Though that staff team was complemented by a lot of volunteers, and I want to especially recognize the two co-chairs of our committee, Regional Planning and Investments Committee. That's Paul Nowicki from Burlington Northern Santa Fe and Pedro Ceballos from Primera Engineers. Also, another board member, Paul Carlisle from Wintrust, has been a terrific spokesperson, including yesterday with the Sun-Times editorial board. I hope you take a look at that editorial that pretty much nails the message that we hope to deliver today. And Larry Booth, a former board member, and his colleagues at Booth Hansen for their assistance in giving us a flavor about what these stations could physically look like and inspiring us to get it right. If you know others who couldn't join us today, your colleagues, friends, people that you run into on the train going home or the bus, you can tell them that they can register for tomorrow morning's webinar. So from 10 to 10:30 tomorrow morning, there'll be a webinar with the researchers explaining why they developed the route screening method, how it's making a difference, and what potential it could have to change our city and our region. And you can register at our website, plus get lots more information at metroplanning.org. Today's event is being recorded through an MPC partnership with Chicago Amplified, which is a project of Chicago Public Radio. And the audio will be available on WBEZ and MPC's websites in about a week. One quick plug, we get excited about innovation, no surprise, about this topic, but about other things as well. There's something called the Apps for Metro Chicago effort, and we're involved with a contest, also known as A4MC. Apps for Metro Chicago is challenging web developers to help us use the newly open city, county, and state data to help people design new apps, mobile apps, so that we can find, create, sustain, and or share public spaces. You'll be able to apply online starting August 28th through September 30th, and there's going to be a $2,500 prize thanks to IBM for the winning mobile app. Today's format is a very full, hopefully informative program, and if we stay on schedule a little after 1:30, we should be done with our four speakers and have sufficient time before we conclude at 2 o'clock for your questions. There are note cards at every table. Please don't wait to the end of the presentations to begin to jot down your cards. My colleagues from MPC will be making their way around the room to collect those cards, and my colleague Peter Scozzi will be prioritizing those, combining questions so that we get to the maximum number of questions today. I also want to give a warm and special welcome to the Consul General of Colombia, Jose Fernando Gomez Mora. We're delighted that you are in Chicago and able to join us today. And now to our speakers. Our primary speaker has, of course, traveled the longest distance. We are delighted to welcome Bogota's former mayor and also a candidate for mayor again, Enrique Peñalosa. He is the board chair of ITDP, so he's wearing a couple different hats, both as an innovator in his hometown and also as an international spokesperson for gold standard BRT, which we want to be the first U.S. city to win that mantle. What we've done for all of our speakers is give you a bio, a paragraph, so please do take a look at that. I'm going to compress my time and not read highlights of that, but I will say that Mayor Peñalosa is a citizen of the world. I was interested to see that he attended Duke University in North Carolina. He studied graduate school in Paris, and I know this morning he just came from the City Council where he had a chance to talk about some of his other initiatives on libraries, parks, and significantly on pedestrian and biking enhancements. That's not our focus today, but no surprise, an innovator on one front is an innovator on multiple fronts, and we've got a lot to learn from Enrique Peñalosa. His presentation, we've given him a substantial amount of time because he's traveled a substantial distance to be with us, and we want to maximize that. We will then hear from Annie Weinstock. Annie is the lead at ITDP on BRT, and she hasn't just worked domestically in the U.S. She has worked all around the globe, as you will see in her bio. It's very impressive, and leading up to today, we've already found the value of being her colleague and partner. She's going to help us understand what exactly goes into winning that, that moniker of gold standard BRT and what we need to grapple with to get it right here. Josh Ellis, project manager at MPC, will follow and tell you more about the work, the research, the analysis that we partnered with the public agencies, CTA, CDOT, to analyze every street in the city of Chicago to produce the 10 recommended routes that are most feasible for BRT. Not just that it can work from an engineering perspective, although it makes that meets that test, but also to share with you a method that we believe is groundbreaking and that is applicable to other infrastructure investments we face in our region, and that others can make use of in prioritizing their investments. Following that discussion of the methods and the results, we will, as our last speaker, hear from Commissioner Gabe Klein. Gabe has also relocated to Chicago recently, and we are delighted that he decided to do so. He is the former commissioner of the D.C. Department of Transportation, and he's also been an innovator in the private sector at Zipcar, and he's quite an avid bicyclist as well and proponent of bicycling. He has hit the ground running with the same kind of frenetic energy as his boss, Mayor Emanuel, and we're delighted to capture partner with him to put that energy to good use to see the potential realized on bus rapid transit for Chicago. So thank you to the four of you for working with us to get to this point today, and I know there's a lot of work ahead. So join me in a warm, warm Chicago welcome for Enrique Peñalosa.
Thank you very much. I'm trying to get my remote to work. Thank you very much to Mary Sue Barrett and to the Metropolitan Planning Council, and of course to the Chicago Department of Transport and Gabe Klein, and to Chicago Transit Authority. And I am very glad to be here on ITDP's behalf. Good. The topic today is to invite you to reconsider buses and how buses can be fully utilized and why haven't they been used in a better way in the past. BRT apparently is very simple because it's not something that requires a lot of money. Is not something very technically complex. So what are the challenges for good BRT? The challenges are two. One is political, because clearly it is difficult mainly to take space away from cars and give it exclusively to buses. So there is a political challenge. If we think in terms of equality, of democracy, clearly a bus with 100 passengers or 50 passengers has a right to 50 times or 100 times the amount of road space that a car with one has. And the second one, of course, is the most efficient way to use a very scarce resource, which is road space. Basic BRT has to do with the prepaid boarding, with level boarding at stations, with exclusive lanes, with overpass at stations so that we can have express buses, some buses that should stop at every station and some others. But let's go into the presentation. Quality cities require great pedestrian spaces. Public pedestrian space is an end in itself, makes life better, makes people happier. Transport, good transport is not an end in itself, it's just a means. Great transport will not make people happy. But great transport allows a city to have great public pedestrian space, and so it is a mean that is necessary for great public pedestrian space. All public transport is wonderful. Of course, rail is wonderful, but that's very obvious. Everybody agrees with that. What is not so obvious is why buses can be wonderful as well. And I will try to prove to you that in some ways, buses have significant advantages over rail. It's not just cheaper. It's not just lower cost. But there are some advantages that are interesting about buses. One question is, if buses are so wonderful, Why did Paris, London, or New York did not create BRT systems instead of subways? Two reasons. One is that when the first subway was put into operation, about 1860, there was still like 70 years more for buses to come into operation. Buses really, we did not have the technology. Towards 1910, for example, all streets in the world were still being made as they were made in the Roman times with cobblestones. And so, and buses and the technology for to have pneumatic tires for heavy vehicles was not developed yet. So imagine with a solid rubber tire going in cobblestones, it was impossible. The only way to have a smooth ride was with rail. And so we only began to have buses towards in the 1930s, and really, in fact, towards 1935. So when London or New York were built, or Paris, actually, there were not even cars. So the only way to move about in 1890 or 1900 in London was rail. So this is why these cities have a giant amount of rail networks. By 1940, about every city in the world with more than 100,000 inhabitants had trams. Bogota had trams. And all over India, Pakistan, Latin America, everybody had trams, every city. And then buses appeared. And in a matter of about one or two decades, all trams disappeared. And it was not just because of this story we all know about, that the General Motors bought a few tram lines and then they scrapped them and all this very, very interesting story. But it's basically because this is completely marginal to what happened all over the world. Trams disappeared basically because they had a bad image of being low quality, poor service, a service for the poor, basically something very similar as buses have today. And that's why buses replaced trams, because buses were sexy then. Buses were the modern thing, the cool thing to have at that time. And they replaced trams all over the world. So marketing is not a minor issue here when we are talking about transport. I mean, maybe there is few things are so linked to status as transport. I mean, this is why people buy $500,000 cars, which maybe if they are blindfolded, they would not be able to differentiate from a $40,000 car. So this is why, for example, when we created our system, we gave it a name that is called Transmilenio, because of course, the buses in Bogota, as everywhere else, they had a reputation, a stigma of being a system for the poor, bad quality, all that. So we needed the new system to be different, that people should refer to them as Transmilenio, which sounded very modern or something, you know. And we were lucky because in Bogota, people made clearly a difference between the traditional bus system and the Transmilenio. Nobody who is going to take Transmilenio ever would say that he's going to take or she's going to take the bus. So marketing is it's very important. I mean, it has even to do, for example, in Australia, they tell me when I've been working there, say, look, Australian men do not like to take buses. This is a little sissy thing, you know? They may be able to leave the car, but only for the train, never for the bus. So these are important issues. This is not just engineering issues. This has a lot to do with marketing, with design, with many other things which are related to why people use public transport or not. But it is important also to know that even with a few subway lines, buses will be crucial. In London, for example, London has about 8 million inhabitants. I understand something similar to Chicago metropolitan area, or I don't know. 8 million inhabitants, and London has 1,800 kilometers, about 1,200 miles of subway and suburban rail. And still they move more than 1 million people more by bus than by rail. Despite the fact that, of course, they allow the best routes to the rail, the best corridors, they give it to rail. So even if we have a lot of subway, we will always need buses. However, most American cities don't have the densities to really make full use of rail. So buses are even more relevant. Yesterday I was coming from the airport in a traffic jam, of course, in both directions. And the train, which is wonderful, going in the middle, was very, very low frequency, only one every few minutes, and it didn't seem to be very full. Maybe because we don't have that much of a density. But now, we are going to argue, and I'm going to try to argue, that buses are not just good because they have lower cost. However, the difference in cost is astounding. It's enormous. For example, in Sao Paulo, which is the Latin American case that we have, the latest subway lines that have been built underground, they cost between $250 and $300 million per kilometer. I understand that in New York, the Second Avenue line is even costing more than $1 billion per kilometer. But of course, other subways, even in China, we are talking about $90 million kilometer subway line. So it's, while a good BRT, even making all, including all the lanes for cars and sidewalks and everything, may cost maybe $20 million per kilometer at the most. And I'm not including the buses because, as I will mention later, we contract them out with private operators. We have some improved bus systems with some BRT characteristics, which are very important. However, they are not fully BRT. And we will talk later about exactly what this is. Now, rail is always well done. Rail, every subway that is built is well done. And I know dozens of cases, if not hundreds of cases, where there are very huge cost overruns to the rail investments. Even when they are trams, such as happened in Denver, where they have huge cost overrun, not just underground systems, but even surface systems. But they are always well done, because you cannot just leave a hole there half abandoned. So they always are well finished, even if you have to pay 50% more or 100% more, whatever it takes, you will do a good system. With bus systems, it tends to happen the opposite. You design first a beautiful BRT, and then there is budgetary constraints. So you say, oh, but maybe we cannot do this, you know. Let's not have this, or either for political or economic reasons, we begin to reduce. Initially, we designed, for example, that the buses should go through the most congested street downtown. But then they say, oh, that's politically too complicated. Why don't we just move it to a couple of blocks farther away? Or then we don't have enough money. So we say, oh, we were going to redo these sidewalks. But now we can leave that for some other time. So, and then after we finish the system, then we say, oh, look, the BRT doesn't work. See, it's no good. But so if we want something to work well, we have to design the best, in the best location, in the best route, the best public space improvements, every little detail, and then we can achieve the hoped-for results. But it's very dangerous because, as I say, exactly as it is the opposite with rail systems, which are always perfect when they are finished, with buses we tend to cut budget and do political shortcuts as well. Why ITDP, as board, maybe being a member of the board of ITDP, we are very interested in having in the United States a top quality BRT. Why? Because every time we go to India or China or Thailand, the best argument not to do good public transport or to do this is, or to do BRT, look at the United States. Where is it that they have it? So you are a model to the world. Whatever happens here has great impact. It's totally different if we have a good BRT in Bogota than if you have a good BRT in Chicago. I mean, it's an example to the world, and it can have a great impact if we do a full-fledged BRT. Operational costs are also very different. We have found in the United States over the last few years that there are enormous financial problems in subway systems. I don't know the case of Chicago, but clearly in New York, in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco. And why does it happen? Because most of the costs for rail systems are depreciation. And it's very easy to hide real costs. And all of a sudden you find with systems which are completely in very bad shape, and you have had some very horrible accidents in Washington, D.C., and arguably they have happened because there was not the adequate maintenance. And so, but if we really account fully for the operational cost, even though labor costs in the United States are much higher, we tend to have higher operational costs per passenger for rail than for buses. Here we have some interesting examples in France, what they call buses with high level of service. And you see how, towards the future, in France, they expect, this is French government statistics, they expect to do more and more what they call buses with high level of service, which is BRTs or close to BRT systems. Even though we have an enormous rail industry in France, which has, by the way, is mostly government owned. So there is a huge lobby to do more and more trams and trains, and still the advantages, some advantages of buses are so evident that they expect to do more, like this one in Transvaal de Marne, I don't want in 1993, or this one opened in Rouen, exclusive lane and that kind of system which moves 45,000 passengers per day. Or this one opened in 2006 in Nantes, by the way, which was the first city in France to put the modern tram, the new kind of trams in 1985. And still, they are doing these kind of systems. One thing about buses is that in the United States, most rail equipment tends to be imported, while buses, in this time where so many jobs are needed, tend to be built here. Now, what are the obstacles to BRT? Again, as I mentioned already, the perception that it's an inferior system. The trams are beautiful. I mean, a tram is beautiful. A modern tram is a beautiful piece of equipment. But also we can make buses and public spaces that look very nice. Even this traditional, the 16th Street Mall in Denver, you can see how with architecture, I'm not saying you should do this, but just as an example, what you can do with architecture to make a busway look very nice with great architectural design. This is an example of what they did in Bogota. We made, everywhere we have put the BRT in Bogota, the Transmilenio, we have made improvements in public pedestrian space. And I'm showing this picture for you to see that we are making demolitions. We buy buildings alongside in order to make bigger and better public pedestrian space. Here, of course, Chicago has one of the best public space and sidewalks anywhere in the planet. Yet, it's very important that we make improvements to public pedestrian space. The main issue in order to oppose BRT and to propose trams in the United States, and I have found this in many cities, is that it is said that rail systems stimulate private investment, and that buses do not. That buses do not have this kind of impact. And I believe this is not necessarily true, because if buses really are well done, they can have the same or very similar impact in terms of stimulating redevelopment, renewed investment downtown, as we can achieve with rail. For example, in the United States, we have that, I hear all the time that trams were crucial to the revitalization of Portland. But Salt Lake City has had trams for just as long. And you see that Salt Lake City looks like a bombed out city. It's full of parking lots. There is nothing happening downtown. is dead. So clearly, the Trump did nothing to increase, to improve Salt Lake City downtown. So it's possible that what happened in Portland is due to other reasons, not just to the fact, I mean, maybe the Trump contributed to it, but clearly there are many other explanations which are not attributable to the investment in the Trump. What investors need to see is an effective transit system which works, which improves the way the city looks, and which cannot be easily taken away. And this can be done with buses. For example, I am not a big fan of shopping malls for urban design reasons. However, there are many in Bogotá, and since we started operations of Transmilenio in 2010, all shopping malls which have been built in Bogotá have been built on Transmilenio trunkways. Even though Transmilenio trunkways only are about 20-25% of the main arteries in the city so far, it's not because they are everywhere in the main arteries. No, there are many arteries in the city, big roads, without Transmilenio, and shopping malls are not located there. So, as you see this picture, for example, of a typical Bogotá section of the, we improve the sidewalks, we put trees, we do a lot of improvements everywhere around the BRT. And then happens this. This is a sign. In developing countries, the upper income people rarely take public transport. One of the successes, for example, of Transmilenio is that we attract 18% of the people who use Transmilenio every day are car owners who prefer to leave the car at home. Why do they leave the car at home? Because they love Transmilenio, because it's so comfortable? No. Basically, because of the same reasons people use public transport anywhere in the world. People do not use public transport in New York or in Hong Kong or in Tokyo because they love the subway. People use public transport because they have to, because there are severe restrictions to using the car because it takes time or because there is no place to park. For whatever reason, the fact is that almost 20% of the users of Transmilenio every day are car owners. And see this sign, what this sign says, hey, this is an ad advertising apartments, high income apartments, and it says, you should invest here because you are going to be able to earn the increased value that the new Transmilenio trunkway will bring. This is what this sign says. This is a study that is done by a very sophisticated institution in Colombia. It's a private institution financed by the developers and real estate people. And they ask the people the reasons to choose a new house they buy. And in Bogotá, for example, the main criteria to choose is 69% of the people say the main criteria to buy a new house is that it's close to mass transit. So, as you see, in Medellín, for example, another Colombia city which has subway, only 41% of the people say the criteria is to be close to mass transit. So, clearly, Transmilenio is having a tremendous impact on citizens' investment behavior. This is, for example, ANAT, the biggest construction company in Bogotá, the biggest developing company. They buy two pages of magazines like this everywhere. And so they put a map of the city, they put the map of the Transmilenio, on there even the little buses, maybe you cannot see them, but they have even painted the little buses there. And then they locate the projects they have for sale on the map. Because they clearly realize that one of the main selling points is to be the proximity to Transmilenio. Transmilenio has increased land values all around where it goes. So it's exactly the same as you would have achieved with a subway line or with a tram line. It clearly increases land values and makes it attractive for a new investment, both in a commercial office and housing and residential real estate. Now, I ask you, let's hope never happens, but if there was a crisis, and maybe some earthquake or some war or something, and there was only fuel for 5% of the vehicles in the city, to whom would you allocate this scarce fuel? Clearly, you would allocate this scarce fuel to buses or to trucks, because otherwise it would be to commit suicide. The city would die. I mean, it actually would physically die. You would not be able to make production go and to distribute food and to bring people to work. Now, let's imagine that what is scarce is not fuel, but what is scarce is road space. How do we distribute road space? How will we allocate road space? If road space is scarce, I think we also have to allocate road space to buses and trucks. Look, the most valuable resource a city has, such as Chicago, beyond its people, is road space. If we were to find oil or diamonds under Chicago's soil, it would not be so valuable as road space. It's an extremely valuable resource. So how should we allocate it? How should we allocate it? How should we distribute it between pedestrians, bicyclists, public transport, and cars? What I will try to tell you is that I'm not going to tell you how you should distribute it. All I'm going to say is that this is a political decision. This is not a technical decision. It's not like if you have more space for cars, you will solve traffic. I mean, it's not like there is not such a thing as an equilibrium. Or it's not like if you invest more and more in road space and make bigger and bigger roads, one day you will wake up and, oh, eureka, we reached equilibrium, no more traffic jams. No. If there was more road space for cars in Manhattan, there would be more cars. If there was less space for cars, there would be less cars. As simple as that. This is, so the issue is, how do we want to distribute this? This is very much a political issue, and I would say it comes almost to a constitutional principle. As I mentioned at first, the first article in the Constitution of the United States, as in every democratic constitution in the world after the United States, says all citizens are equal before the law. All citizens are equal before the law. And if this is true, clearly a bus with 100 passengers has a right to 100 times more road space than a car with one person. And even we can even begin to talk about the space that now, here for example, when we were walking from city council to here, there were cars parked in both sides of the street. Both sides of the street was taken by parked cars. And that's fine, but again, I look at the United States Constitution or at any constitution in the world, and we find many rights, constitutional rights. The right to housing, the right to work, the right to education, the right, many rights. But I don't find the right to park. This is not. So, I mean, if you take this parking away, and some citizens will come and argue, where should I park? They will argue to the mayor, to government. And then the mayor can tell them, well, it's the same as if you come and ask me where you should put your clothes or your food, you know? This is a private issue. Again, I am not saying you should take this parking away. All I'm trying to say is that this is not nothing set, that this is a political decision, that this is neither technical, nor this is a right. So, if you say, for example, where there is space for lanes for buses or for lanes for bicycles, at least we can begin by taking away the space for cars, or at least this is a political decision. This is nothing, there is nothing technical or constitutional about this. So you may decide not to take this space away, fine, but at least we must have clear that this is a decision, a political decision, and there is not, that we are not talking about sacred issues. Here, for example, in Bogota, sometimes, very often, we do not want to bring buses to the most congested streets downtown because they say, oh no, that's too difficult. Because people often say, oh, we can put the BRT here and the BRT there. Oh, but not there because it's too congested. So we cannot put the buses there. So we should say, look, here we have a democracy. When we have too much traffic in a street, what we have to say is, oh, the street space is too narrow. Therefore, we cannot put cars there. Because if we have a democracy, public transport has to have a priority in the use of scarce road space. And so we have to put the buses in the most critical areas. We cannot just move the BRT two blocks or three blocks away just in order to avoid the more complicated streets. Here in Bogota, downtown, for example, we had one of the most crucial streets downtown and there was no space, so we had to take the cars away. Of course, it was difficult, but it works. So this is the way it is at the end. And this happens in many cities in the world. This is nothing very special. This is in the Netherlands, or in Zurich, or in Melbourne. This is very common to take, sometimes, this is nothing very revolutionary. Even I have pictures of San Diego, I don't know if here, this is another Colombian city, not Bogota, or in the Netherlands again, and even I saw the trams with exclusive lanes in San Diego, for example. So this is not some kind of revolutionary idea or concept. Again, this is to illustrate that in London, for example, they give more space to pedestrians in downtown London than to motor vehicles. See the big sidewalks and very narrow street. This is not because some transport engineer gave them permission. This is a political decision. Because again, if we had bigger space, more space for cars, the traffic problem would be exactly the same. When we have a lot of traffic in one street, I would say it's just an indication that the street is ripe for public transport. Such as here with Transmilenio in Bogota. Now, buses in highways. I'll show you, when we make a highway, I understand that for the last 40 years, traffic has been getting worse in the entrances to all American cities, everywhere, despite giant highways. So at least if we have a highway, we should have exclusive lanes for buses in that highway, such as here in Bogota. The road is jammed, but then the buses go very quickly, such as they could go to the airport. They go by the train that you have now. Or in Istanbul. But here, this is the one I wanted to show you because it's an interesting case in Spain. In the road entering Madrid from La Coruña, they put this exclusive lane for buses. And what is fascinating is that they have two almost parallel suburban rail lines coming into the city, almost parallel to this road. And the bus lane is moving more passengers than the two suburban rail lines added up together, despite the fact that the suburban rail lines are hugely subsidized and the buses are not subsidized. Not only are they not subsidized, but they contributed almost 50 million euros to build the station infrastructure downtown Madrid where they arrived to. So why do people prefer to take the bus? Why I would imagine that many people would prefer to take the bus and not the train to the airport? For the following reason. Because the buses can collect passengers much closer to the origin of their trip. For example, they can collect them very near where they live at home. And once they enter the highway, they go just as fast as the train. So buses in general can have this disadvantage. And this is why sometimes for this kind of structure that you have in Chicago, for example, that people are going out from the Chicago center to the suburbs or vice versa, maybe some bus systems with exclusive lanes on highways maybe work much more effectively than the rail, because they can collect people much closer to the origin of their trip and leave them much closer to the destination. Now, we are going to talk now about a few issues: capacity, speed, comfort. Now, this is what we had in Bogota before. We have about 35, 1,000 buses, individually owned almost. They were the most powerful political organization in the city. They would come to a, they would go on strike and block the whole city. And if there was a chance that somebody could move in other vehicles, they would just put a few buses across the streets and would block the whole city. So we had to get these people as shareholders of the new system. By the way, our buses are not government-owned. We think it's extremely inefficient to have very unionized government-owned buses. And a bus, a government is so politicized in Bogotá that we believe a government-owned bus would leave the north of the city and arrive to the south with another engine, you know. They would steal the fuel, they would steal the tires, they would, I mean, it would be. So we prefer to have private contractors. And who are the private contractors? They are the same, they are companies which have as shareholders the former owners of the traditional buses, mostly, not all of them, but mostly. So we believe this is much better, and we pay these people as per kilometer. Many times I've come in an American Airlines plane, and I see when I am coming into the plane, oh, operated by Caribbean Air or something. I mean, it's clearly the bus I am entering. I mean, this is the pilot wears an American Airlines uniform, the stewardess as well, the people at the airport is American, but actually the plane is operated by a completely different company. It has nothing to do with American. The only thing they are paid to operate these planes. It's the same basic principle, the way our buses operate. And if it's more efficient in the private sector, such for American Airlines, imagine the comparison by a government-owned bus system. It's completely different and more efficient. So, the capacity. Transmilenio now is moving 47,000 passengers hour direction at peak hours. This is more than all subway lines in the world, except for 6 or 7. And we can make a few adjustments, which is our constraints now. The stations are too small, and we have to make bigger stations. And with a few adjustments, we are certain we can bring this up to 65,000 passengers hour direction, which is more than any subway in the planet, except for a couple. By the way, we are still a small system. We only have about 84 kilometers of Transmilenio. There are about 35 more under construction. With these 84 kilometers, which is about 60 miles or something, we are moving 1.7 million passengers hour. This is very important that we look at this picture. Well, first of all, I think this is a picture of democracy, because it really shows that public transport has a priority over private cars. But beyond that, we need to see how at the station we have two lanes. We have two lanes. Because we need some buses to stop at every station and some buses to be express buses, to go only every 5 or 6 or 10 stations. The same, this you cannot do with a subway. Only there are 5 or 6 express subway lines in the world, but this means really you have to have 2 subway lines, one next to the other, and that costs a lot of money. But this increases the capacity of the system, not from 1 to 2, but from 1 to 5. This is crucial to capacity. I'm sure in Chicago you don't need this, because at least initially you don't need this kind of thing. But it's just interesting to understand how this works. Of course, the stations are also level stations. We have to have prepaid stations. You know, in Santiago de Chile, they started a huge BRT program, and they almost have a revolution and throw the president out because they made many mistakes. One of the mistakes they made is they did not make enough stations. So if you don't have prepaid tickets, imagine somebody going up where you have 15 or 20 people at a station and everybody with a little card there, you know, and then somebody's card doesn't read well, and then it's 2 minutes there waiting for the card to read, and also you need level ground. See, this is like a ramp, so everywhere is accessible to wheelchairs, for example, in our case, without any slow system of lowering down a ramp or anything, or kneeling bus or anything like this. Okay. Well, now this is, we have moved, with only 84 kilometers, we have moved up to 1.7 million passengers per day. This is the most it has moved. So this is huge. Now, Guangzhou's BRT, which ITDP helped implant, is moving 27,000 passengers, more than all Chinese subway lines except Beijing number 2 line. But of course, Transmilenio moves more than even Beijing number 2 line. This is Guangzhou, a giant Chinese city with 12 million inhabitants. We had just opened this about 6 months ago. Now, speed. We say, oh, rail is faster. No. More important than speed is travel time. For example, if we have two lines in a subway that cross, what do you have to do? You have to get off, walk, and wait for the next train to come. With bus systems, buses can change lanes without the people having to waste time getting off and going to the other train. I mentioned already the express route issue, which you can have with buses and you cannot have with trains. Another thing is that subway normally have stations about 1 kilometer apart from each other. With buses, you can have 500 meters. So walking time from the origin to the station and from the station to the destination, it tends to be shorter. Another, frequencies. You are going to move, for example, 10,000 passengers per hour. You may need 3 or 4 trains. Or you need 80 or 100 buses. So the frequency of buses is much higher and the waiting time is much lower. So even though the train may go a little faster, in fact, the trip may take shorter if you use buses. Comfort. One advantage of trains is that normally they are more smooth. The ride is smoother than with buses, which to read or something like this tends to be a little jumpier unless you do wonders with pavements. But in other ways, for example, it's much more pleasant to be in the surface, such as you have your trains here, than to be underground. Another thing, I was in Singapore. And they told, in Singapore, they think they are the best in everything. And they are. And they are in many ways. And so they say public transport is their priority, and they are perfect. And I say, and if public transport is your priority, why do you give these wonderful highways full of flowers and trees to the private cars, and you put public transport underground, like moles? You know? Why don't you put some buses to go? When I was a student in Paris, I used to work 4 nights a week in a hotel all night long. And I was tired, and I had to go to my university next day. And at that time, I did not care about this transport issue, so I was not trying to prove a point or anything. But I would prefer to take the bus that took me much longer because I wanted to see the city and the light and all this. It wasn't, even though I was very tired after working all night. So it's much nicer if you don't have to be underground and you can enjoy the city. And people normally feel safer. Even in Manhattan, I see many people prefer, especially late at night, they feel safer taking a bus or not. Now, stairs. Over the last time I was in Washington, D.C., these huge stairs, I mean, maybe a nuclear bomb refuge or something, they were impossible and they were broken. So you had to walk like for a mile up the stairs, you know. Now, everything in Transmilenio is contracted out to the private sector, not just the bus operations, the fare collection, the fare card system, everything. So the out of the whole income of Transmilenio, only 4% of the income goes to the public company, basically to operate, to regulate the operation of the system. The buses of Transmilenio pay all taxes, pay fuel taxes, import duties, income taxes, the companies, every tax. They have no tax exemption whatsoever in anything. And now BRTs are going in many ways. In Colombian cities, we have, this is in Cali, Colombia, we have 7 Colombian cities are now operating these systems. Or of course, this is Brisbane in Australia, was a very sophisticated bus system. But again, in Brisbane, they are afraid that the train is sexier. So now they are thinking of doing more rail investment, but since the floods, they ran out of money, so they are postponing it, but, and Guangzhou. So I just finish by saying I truly believe that we can do wonders with buses. Buses were not well used, again, because as I mentioned, when subway started, we still had 60, 70 years more to have buses available. And when buses appeared towards 1930, 1935, nobody cared about public transport anymore. We were into cars at that time. So buses were never really given a good chance. And I believe, even though in the United States, of course, the labor costs are higher, there are many wonderful things that can be done with buses, especially if we complement them with great public space improvements and excellent marketing strategies. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I want to thank the MPC for putting this together and for having me here, and also Mayor Peñalosa for another excellent presentation. So now you've seen proof that high-quality BRT has been implemented all around the world. My organization, the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy, has been instrumental in supporting the development of many of these projects, most recently the BRT that opened in Buenos Aires. But yet we haven't seen BRT of that caliber yet implemented in the United States. So what do I mean when I say that caliber? It's what we refer to as gold standard BRT. Here again is Transmilenio. It's pretty much the top of the top for gold standard BRT. You've seen a lot about it, so I won't talk much more about it. It's easy for cities to say that they have gold standard BRT, but international experience tells us that there's a broad set of characteristics that are necessary in order for a system to really be gold standard. To that end, we developed a scoring system, which we call the BRT standard scoring system. It's similar to the LEED certification scoring system in that there's a whole range of criteria. Each one is given weight. This is just a small excerpt. It's a lot longer than this. And the idea is that it can be used to rate BRT systems as either gold, silver, bronze, or even not BRT. So I'm not going to have time to go through every one of these characteristics. There's a lot. I'm going to choose a few. It's kind of like choosing your favorite children. But here's one of the most important is median aligned bus lanes separated from traffic. So I think most BRT planners today get that there's a need to separate buses from traffic. This eliminates conflicts with automobiles. The problem is that a lot of times it's done on the curbside, and this often still creates conflicts with vehicles that are pulling over into the curb lanes, making deliveries. Even there are a lot of right turns from the curb lane into driveways. So in most of the best international systems, the bus lanes are pulled into the central verge, which really reduces a lot of the conflict. And our scoring system awards even extra points if a city is able to reduce or eliminate left turns across the busway. This is actually a lot better for operational efficiency of buses at intersections than even transit signal priority. In a lot of cities, especially downtown, there are one-way streets. So this is an example from Johannesburg, South Africa, of how you can still have a median-aligned busway in the central verge. You have one-way traffic on either side of the busway, and they have designated points at which they can cross over. There's many other ways to do this. This is just one example. Off-board fare collection, as Mayor Peñalosa has already mentioned, can be a huge time savings. If you have a line of 20 people waiting to board the bus and pay their fare, they may be shuffling through their wallet to find the correct change. They may not know how to use the fare box machine. And so if you pull that off of the bus and put it at the stations, then you can save minutes at every station, at every time the bus has to stop. This actually, in general bus systems, buses stopped at stations and what's called dwell time is often worse than buses stuck in mixed traffic. Mayor Peñalosa also mentioned this, having your bus floor level with the station platform. This saves a few seconds per passenger It eliminates the cumbersome step up or step down onto the bus. And when you eliminate a few seconds per passenger, that really adds up. It also allows wheelchairs to go right onto the bus. And having extra wide doors and multiple doors allows more passengers to board and alight at the same time, which also speeds up the process. Iconic stations, these signify to passengers that this is something more than a regular bus system. They signify to developers that this is something permanent. They make BRT more easily recognizable and identifiable to passengers. And they help a system become a real part of a city. So I just want to give a really quick tidbit from South Africa again. This is I worked in Johannesburg, so it keeps coming up. They built these stations, as you can see in the top right image, that are kind of, they have these pointy tops, and Johannesburg citizens call them the hedgehogs. And now they've become a part of Johannesburg. Everyone identifies their city with these hedgehog stations. Ironically enough, Cape Town liked them so much that Cape Town built the same thing. So now it's no longer Johannesburg thing, but it kind of it shows you the power of really nice, well-designed stations. The network effect of BRT, the idea that, yes, you can have buses go on from one corridor to another. You don't have to force passengers to make transfers at transfer points, which often deters a lot of people who otherwise may have driven to take public transportation. If you allow buses to travel from one corridor to another, you're providing passengers with a one-seat ride, which is really crucial to getting more people onto the bus. Here's another big transportation network from Tehran, which just built a whole BRT network. This is also kind of similar in that one of the benefits of buses is that they can go on and off of a corridor with dedicated infrastructure versus, say, a light rail system or even traditional bus planning where you have one bus corridor and many smaller buses feeding into it. So the top image is this trunk and feeder type model. The bottom image is direct services, and this allows passengers to get a lot closer to their homes. A lot of cities are implementing bike share programs. I think Chicago is starting to think about it a little bit. It's becoming popular all over the world. And having bike share at stations is a way of allowing passengers to travel that extra mile that they may not be able to get to with the bus system. So it actually broadens your catchment area for passengers and gives you potential for higher ridership. So where is BRT in the U.S.? In the last year, with the help of the Rockefeller Foundation, myself and a colleague of mine at the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy traveled around the U.S. just trying to get a sense of what was going on, what was already in place, what was being planned. We came to Chicago, even met a bunch of you, and it seems that things are actually moving in the right direction, but still, they're, in most cases in the U.S., when a city says they have bus rapid transit, it's usually enhanced bus service. That's not to say that these cities aren't going to eventually implement bus rapid transit, but what they have now is often buses stuck in traffic, buses that have to go around vehicles that are parked in bus lanes. There is true bus rapid transit in 5 cities today. Cleveland, Ohio has the Health Line. Los Angeles, California has the Orange Line. Eugene, Oregon has the Emerald Express. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania has the East Busway, and Las Vegas, Nevada has the Strip Downtown Express. They're all really good examples of BRT. They're really worth seeing if you're in any of those cities. Yet they rank on our scoring system as bronze. They're not yet there at gold. We think that there's a really good chance that in the next few years there will be at least one U.S. city with gold standard BRT. We have our eyes on a few of them. San Francisco Bay Area, especially the East Bay, has some pretty good plans that are already in process. Chicago, obviously, that's why we're here. We think that there's a lot of great political leadership and the stars are aligning here. And then in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., Montgomery County, there are plans for a 160-mile BRT network, and there's a lot of support for it. So we think that gold standard BRT is still to come in the U.S. very soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie, and thank you to the mayor. I'm Josh Ellis from the Metropolitan Planning Council. I want to reiterate my thanks to all of you for being here today, as well as our external partners that helped us with our presentation, the study, CTA, CDOT, CMAP, and everybody else, and the project team, Josh Anderson in particular, my co-lead on the project, as well as everybody else. Probably don't need to skip to the end of my presentation. We can go to the beginning. I was amused listening to the mayor's description of people standing on the bus steps watching 20 other people with their cards or with loose change or with money. And just as a curiosity, and I know that every hand in the room is going to go up, but how many people have sat on a Chicago bus watching 20 people in line with their cards or with some currency, and the bus driver's like, I'm not a cashier, just swipe the card or get off. How many people have sat on a bus nervously watching that clock that's at the front and watching their watch and looking at the agenda for the meeting they get to and watching the clock and watching the watch and watching the 20 people and going, man, this is never going to work. Anybody? Yeah. We can do better than that, Chicago. So what I'm going to talk about today is the study that we did to identify a vision for bus rapid transit here in Chicago. The process, why we developed the process that way, some of the results, and then where we see this going from here. MPC for 77 years now, more than 77 years, has been working on livability issues here in the Chicago region. And for livability, we mean robust, vibrant neighborhoods throughout the city and the region. We mean strong local economies. We mean connectivity between those areas so that you can get to the places in which you live your lives, whether it's the stores, the parks, the libraries. And we mean an integration of land use planning and transportation, so we're not just all willy-nilly running all over the place. We have really concentrated development and vibrant communities. Transit is the framework or the structure on which all of that is built, right? Transit is supposed to get us to the places in which we live our lives. We want that network effect that Annie was just talking about. So we've been preaching this gospel of livability for a long time. And a couple of years ago, the federal government started preaching it back to us, which was very exciting. And the HUD, the EPA, and DOT announced these six livability principles. And they said, we are going to start investing in cities and in regions and in neighborhoods that also want to invest in ways that are complementary to these six principles. Okay, and here they are. There they are, and there they are. And you can read them. At the same time, the FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, solicited input. They asked, how can we do this? How can we integrate these livability criteria in a quantifiable way into our investment decision-making process? How can we ensure that when we invest in your city, we are also investing in these livability goals? They said they wanted to do it. They said they weren't quite sure how to do it, and they asked for input, and we wanted to answer the call. We also wanted to answer the call by looking at a real potential in Chicago, and that was for us BRT. The BRT discussion in Chicago has been going on for some time. We've looked at pilots, we have some pilots going, and I think there's a lot of momentum from the mayor's office, from CDOT, from CTA, from a whole host of players to make BRT happen. Okay, so we took this idea of scoring for livability and we wanted to apply it to BRT. I'm not going to talk too much about these. BRT does require some certain engineering elements. For the purposes of our study, it was the dedicated lanes and the pay before you board stations because they necessitate a certain right of way that really factored into our analysis. BRT, in addition to being this topic of conversation, makes a lot of sense for us. We do have congestion problems. Mary Sue talked us through them. We do have connectivity issues. It's relatively easy. If you can get to the CTA rail network or you can get to the Metro rail network, it's pretty easy to get downtown. If your destination is not downtown, if your destination is somewhere else, it can be a little harder and it can be a lot slower and it can be a whole heck of a lot more frustrating to get there. So we've got connectivity issues, right? We've got communities that need a boost, right? And BRT can do that with cultivation. And as we've talked, BRT is a lower cost investment than, say, light rail or heavy rail. So it seems to make sense, and it utilizes the infrastructure that we have. Chicago has 4,000 miles of streets, and we can use them better. As the mayor said, we are not of the belief that streets are necessarily for cars. Motor oil and mud flaps, those are for cars. Streets are for people, whether they're in their car, whether they're on a bus, they're on a bike, they're walking, they're pushing a stroller, they're having a cup of coffee, whatever. So we wanted to develop a way to screen more or less all of the streets in Chicago to identify whether you could feasibly build BRT from a construction standpoint and whether building BRT there would be consistent with what we believe are the livability goals of the city. Here's the methodology. There's four phases. I'm going to walk through all of them. We started with this universe of, you see in the blue, of all of the 2009 CTA routes and immediately screened out circulator routes and things like that. I used to live in Hyde Park. We have a couple of different circulator routes to take you from different places in the neighborhood to the university, and they're convoluted and everything. We screened all those out. We wanted to look at long linear corridors. Then we took each of those long streets, your Westerns, your Ashlands, your North Avenues, and we broke them down into segments. So our analysis actually looked at every single block in the city of Chicago that's on those red streets right there, which took a long time. All right, we've talked about streets not necessarily being for cars, but being for people, right? And this is complete streets philosophy. You've got pedestrians, you've got cyclists, you've got people walking their dogs that need a little green space, right? You do need to park, you do need to drive, and you do need to take this BRT. And that, according to our analysis, requires 86 feet of right-of-way from building front to building front. That's the minimum, okay? And that's just to have a travel lane. We've talked about the importance of having stations, and these stations are in the median, either one station for both directions or two stations. Once you add the station requirement, now you're up to 97 feet, okay? So what we did is we started screening out every block in the city of Chicago, looking at its right-of-way, and that's what's 86 feet. So it already starts to cut things down, and you already start to see a network forming. That's just by looking at width. For 97, it screened out a few more things, and then we wanted to make sure that we were talking about, you know, sufficient lengths to really consider further study. And based on study of other BRT systems as well as earlier proposals in Chicago, we 3 miles was our minimum length. And so here are areas of Chicago, corridors that are sufficiently wide for consistent lengths of 3 miles. So you already start to see it narrowing down. All of this is just about feasibility. Where can you dedicate a lane, and where can you have a median station? Then we started in with our livability analysis. I've picked 3 of the criteria that we have here. There's 14, they're all in your paper. I strongly encourage you and hope that you will read the paper. These are 3, and they're about connectivity, they're about system performance, and they're about equity of transit access, okay? The first one, connectivity to educational institutions. We looked at half mile radius around every block in the city and counted up how many high schools, colleges, community colleges, technical academies, those sorts of things are in that. And then we scored every block in the city based on how many educational institutions it had, right? Existing transit ridership, we just did the same thing and looked at how many people are riding buses through that particular section of street. Population not served by rail, this is an equity issue. We wanted to look at where people are living now, where they live more than a half mile from a CTA or metro station, but would live within a half a mile if we were to build this BRT route, okay? When you do that, you can create different visuals, different ways of looking at the city, right? And so this is the map version of those 3 criteria I just showed, right? If we only wanted to prioritize access to education, we look at this map on the left, green is good, red is not as good, and so we would prioritize those corridors if our only goal was access to education, okay? If our only goal was meeting demands of current ridership, you'd have something that looks like the middle, and if our only goal was providing equitable transit access to people who currently don't have it, it would look like it is on the right. We have 14 of these maps. I encourage you to check the appendix. It's online at metroplanning.org. We wanted to have a balanced way of combining all of these things, and for us, connectivity to amenities, equitable transit access, and system performance, for us, were even. We also looked at infill development potential. We looked at parcels of land and whether they were undervalued. We really think that's a criteria that's more helpful after the fact. Once you've identified where these routes are going to be, then you can start targeting investment accordingly. We combined all these scores with the percentages that you see there, and the map on the left shows whether things scored above the median or below the median. So then we really took those that scored above the median and started looking at how you could build a network that connects to existing transit. okay? We had to fill in some gaps, and here's the result. A 10-route network with 21 CTA rail connections, 15 metro station connections, and 12 BRT on BRT connections. Now, what you'll note is that it doesn't look like the existing rail network. It is not this. It's a series of this, right? It allows you much greater access throughout the city, and it goes through neighborhoods currently that do not have a whole lot of ready walking access to transit or the property value bump and the economic development bump that comes with having rapid transit, okay? We wanted to prove that we weren't crazy. We hope that we prove that we're not crazy. And so we went to our friends at CMAP, and we ran that network through their transit demand and traffic impact model. Okay. Here are some of the parameters that we put in. We had to identify station locations along every corridor. All of those maps are also in the appendix, which is also online. And we ran this through there. Now, with the demand model, it was a little tricky because the demand model, you sort of say, if tomorrow we turned on this BRT network, here's what would happen to ridership and traffic. Okay. There's no changes to land use. Vacant lots stay vacant. Okay, all of the things that we would want to happen, all of the complementary investment that we want to see happen around these BRT corridors isn't accounted for in this model. Okay, however, even without all of that, we see a substantial boost in the number of transit riders on these BRT corridors. Trips that start and end on one of these 10 corridors increase 41,000 a day. It's pretty good, right? For the whole region, trips that start on the BRT corridor and end somewhere else, or start somewhere else and end in the BRT corridor, we see an even bigger bump, 71,000, okay? There is an increase in ridership as a result of this improvement, okay? There are some traffic impacts. As you can imagine, you take away a lane of traffic. The model suggested that there would be a whopping 1 mile an hour decrease in traffic speeds on these 10 corridors. From 17 miles an hour to 16 miles an hour, okay? People have alternatives. One alternative would be to get on the bus. And that was also demonstrated by the model that there is this mode shift of an increased number of people relying on the new BRT service and getting out of their cars. Again, this assumes that we only build BRT, and I don't think anyone at MPC is really that interested in only building BRT, right? It has to be the frame and the structure around this much, much larger and coordinated investment effort. In identifying these livability measures, in looking where there are parks, in looking where there are schools, in looking where there are stores that sell fresh fruit, in looking where there are jobs, you also identify where there aren't jobs and where there aren't stores that sell fresh fruit and where there aren't libraries and where there aren't parks. So in addition to understanding where we can build BRT to go to the places where those things exist, we also have a blueprint for understanding where they aren't and what kinds of work we need to do. Our immediate opportunity is on the Western Corridor. CTA and CDOT are initiating a study to look at BRT as an option on either Western or Ashland. Those are included in the Western Corridor. More or less the map that you see here, right? And there's a lot of work there to do about understanding the engineering, understanding the traffic impacts, right? But there's a whole lot of other work that needs to be done by the civic community, by the private sector, and by a whole host of people that you wouldn't think about when you think about transit. Chicago Parks District, Chicago Public Libraries, Chicago Public Schools, Cook County Health and Human Services, right? All of these entities who need to be investing in this network, be part of planning it, need to be at hand. This is an all hands on deck kind of effort here for the city. And that's what we're hoping to pursue over the next several months and year. Thank you all very much for being here. I encourage you to read the report, ask me questions, ask us questions, check it out online, talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors. And remember that cars don't buy ice cream cones, people do. We're the ones who need to be on the streets. Thank you all very much. I do. And Commissioner Klein has a slightly updated presentation, so I have to do some. You step to the microphone, sure. And I'll step to the computer.
I can do a little dance.
You can do a little dance if you want.
Well, while you're doing that, I just wanted to touch on a couple things that Mayor Penalosa mentioned that I think are really, really important. One is highest and best use. Parking, we actually often like parking at CDOT because we use it as a traffic calming mechanism. But the reality is that it's not always the highest and best use of our public space. And one of the things that we really worked hard on in Washington, and I want to work on here, is valuing our public space at its true value and then charging the associated rate or using it for the public good, for what it should be used for. Also, the mayor talked about the importance of marketing. And coming from the private sector, coming from Zipcar, where we had no marketing budget whatsoever, zilch, but through creativity, we were able to build, well, at this point, maybe a $1 billion company, depending on who you talk to. Marketing is hugely important, and the public sector doesn't always get that. And I think when you look at the BRT system in Bogota, they did get that. And in Washington, we launched a second bus service called the Circulator Bus. And the Circulator Bus was just what it sounds like. It was meant to circulate people around the city versus a lot of the metro rail system and the bulk of the bus system, which was a hub and spoke system like we have with the CTA, which is moving people in and out of the city. But we went out on a limb, we bought, and actually this was started before I got there, I expanded it, but we bought these beautiful Van Hool Belgian buses, low floor, big window buses. We allowed people to buy their fares at the parking meters. Parking meters can do a lot, by the way. Bike share actually evolved out of parking meters in terms of the technology. And we put on the side of the bus where the bus went. Nobody knows where the 92 or the 12 or the 33 goes intuitively. So I think that's all very, very important. I think also we need to dispel the myth out there that transit costs all this money, it needs all this subsidy, but roads are free. Driving's pretty low cost. That's not true. I can tell you we spend $1 million a mile in Chicago to repave our streets. So it's not free. Let me dive in here. I think we're a little behind. I believe, I'm actually agnostic when it comes to mode, and I love the idea of BRT. I also started building a streetcar system in Washington. I'm a big fan of layering lots of different options on top of each other, and I think BRT is an excellent option. We were building a streetcar, we had the circulator bus, we had our regular bus. The circulator bus, by the way, was privately contracted, which was hugely important. It was 40% lower cost than the comparable metro bus. We launched the largest bike sharing system in the United States. We added a lot of bikeways. We overhauled our entire parking system. All of this stuff is important, I think, to building a livable, beautiful city and layering all these modes so people have as many options as possible as alternatives to single occupancy vehicle. And people often say to me, in fact, I was quoted in the Washington Post, it was the headline, I was the anti-car czar. And people think I hate cars. And the reality is, I love cars. I have a little smart car. I also have a Vespa. I also have 7 bicycles. I also take the bus. You know, we also have to dispel this myth, I think, that people are one thing. They're a driver. They're a walker. They're a biker. Everybody wants to get to their destination as efficiently and quickly as possible. We have lots of modes in Chicago. And we're trying to make the most of every option. And one thing that the mayor said that also struck a chord with me is that rail is expensive. It's expensive to operate and maintain. The buses do allow some flexibility, quite a bit of flexibility, and lower cost, particularly if you operate it in the private sector, with the private sector. So the message that I want to give today, and I think it's been echoed by everybody that spoke before me, is that Chicago is committed to BRT, and there's a wonderful community of people here working together to make it happen. MPC, CTA, now IDTP or ITDP, Rockefeller. There's a lot of people that want to see this happen. And I think there's some discussion about how it will happen. So what I'm going to do very briefly is just go over what we have in the works and then what are some of the opportunities. But first, why BRT in Chicago? So 26% of Chicago households do not own a car. That's quite a bit. We'd like to see that number go up. In DC, we actually saw car registrations go down 11% from 2006 to 2009 by providing more of these options for people. As the mayor said, BRT is a very cost-effective way to increase service quality for everybody. And that's one of the reasons that we're very excited, actually, about the Western Ave Ashland project. We also think, and thank you, 5 minutes. A lot of the modeling doesn't always take into consideration the fact that you're going to move people from one mode to another. We have that problem with our bike lanes right now. We think we can shift a lot of people out of their cars and into bus rapid transit. We already have a lot of stuff going on Western, and that's really what we should focus on if we have limited time. We already have traffic signal priority started on Western Ave, and we have a pot of money, CMAQ federal money, that we just got this year, or we will be getting, for additional traffic signal prioritization citywide, which could be used on this project. We have the largest automated traffic enforcement system in the country, with almost 400 cameras, and we would use automated enforcement on BRT. We already have the bus and train tracker systems, and we're working on multimodal displays, as well as the fact that CTA is very close to having a really a next generation on off-board fare option for people, which will, I haven't seen it yet because it's very hush-hush, it's in procurement, but it will likely be something better than we've seen before, which will allow people to board buses without any piece of paper or any card. So we have three projects. I'm gonna skip over a lot of this and focus on Western. We have the Jeffrey Boulevard, which is really BRT light. It's BRT dedicated lanes during rush hour. That's fully funded, will open in late 2012. We have the Central Loop Transit Corridor, which is very exciting that it runs right through the downtown. Let's see, that's the Central Loop BRT. And it also includes a new transportation center at Union Station for buses. So we have $25 million of urban circulator funds committed to that, and we're working on the match right now, and that would be up and running in 2014. So what's on the table, where there's a lot of room for different options, is this Western Corridor, Ashland BRT. It's very exciting. It's crosstown. There's been a lot of different projects in Chicago that looked at how could we provide this link. Would we use it through a new subway that linked all these different lines? Would we use the light rail? And in this case, BRT makes perfect sense. It would link every rail line and the Metro Rail network as well. We also have great corridors in terms of ridership, and we think there's definitely opportunities for economic development on this corridor. So as was stated earlier, we have a federal grant for alternatives analysis, and really the question is, how would we implement this? Would it be a public-private partnership? Would it be a phased implementation? Would we go through the small starts and new starts process? What we're interested in is showing how cost-effectively we can do this and how timely we can do it. And I was just out in Eugene recently. I was actually very impressed with their system, which I believe was around $7 million a mile. So it didn't break the bank, and it was a very nice, high-quality system. We think partnering with the private sector, including some of our existing vendors like JCDecaux, that we can accomplish a lot, and we can do it for less money potentially than has been done before, particularly if we focus on modular construction versus custom. And that includes bump outs, that includes bus level stations that are prefabricated. We think we can cut our costs. We also have this other pot of money for the signal prioritization. I think our challenge in the urban core is gonna be queue jumps and those lanes where people can pass, but I think we can do that. But that's probably our biggest issue. And then, as I said before, CTA is already working on this next generation fare. So what's exciting about this is working with ITDP, working with Rockefeller, working with MPC, and working with all of our stakeholders to figure out over the next few months, I think, the most cost-effective way that we can do this, the least bureaucratic way, and to meet the mayor's goal of getting something up and running in the next 36 to 48 months. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, folks. My name is Peter Scosi. I'm Vice President at the Metropolitan Planning Council. I'm going to moderate some quick Q&A. I've got a lot of cards up here, but if somebody's got a zinger they want to run up, please bring them up to me. If someone, one of my staff could bring them up, that'd be great. And then we're going to invite the panelists to respond to some questions, ask if you guys could, as much as possible, keep your answers brief so we can get to as many cards as we can, though we've already got, again, some good questions. Mayor Peñalosa, the first couple of questions I've got are for you. Has Bogota seen any reduction in car ownership as a result of Transmillennial, or any documented reduction in vehicle miles traveled?
No, we are a developing country city, and I don't know about miles traveled, but only 22% of the homes in Bogota own cars. So people want to have cars, and I don't mind that people want cars. That's wonderful, as long as ideally they use them to go out to the countryside on the weekends and and to go out at night, and that for the work trip they should use public transport as much as possible. We have a long ways to go. I must say that our system is far from perfect and wonderful. The main problem that we have is that it's too full. The buses are too crowded, not because of technical capacity, but more because of financial constraints, that if we put more buses and the same income, the Transmilenio is not subsidized at all by government, the operation. So I would love to subsidize it, but that's another issue. But no, we have been increasing the ownership of cars, but again, the more important is not so much the ownership, but that we should get more people into the public transport, even if they have cars.
So, Mayor Peñalosa, could you expand for a second there? You said about subsidies. Do the fares on Transmilenio pay the operating costs?
Fully. The fares, which is about now, over the last 2 years, unfortunately for us, the peso has been increasing very much in value against the dollar, the U.S. dollar. And so now it's about 95 cents of a dollar that cost the Transmilenio. And of course, people can change buses as many times as they want with this fare, and it's not subsidized at all. Not only is not subsidized, as I mentioned, but that, as I mentioned, the buses pay. There is a tax that is like anybody who has a motor vehicle has to pay this road tax or something. Mm-hmm. There is like a registration annual tax. There is a sales tax they have to pay, an income tax that they have to pay. The buses have a lot of imported parts, and so they have to pay import duties, so they pay all the. Moreover, there is another worse thing that they are paying now. As I showed you in one slide, there were still many thousands of these traditional buses. So now, for each of these, we have this crazy rule that the red buses, when they come in, they have to buy and scrap up to 9 traditional buses. So this is very, why do I say it's crazy? Because we should have taxed car owners in order to pay for the scrapping of the traditional buses, not bus users. We are really charging bus users for scrapping of the traditional buses. And now, so this almost doubles the price of a red bus. So not only do they not get any subsidy, but they have all kinds of taxes at this moment, which I hope will get better in the future.
Thank you. Josh, a couple of questions all along the same vein, asking about why some of the routes stop short of Midway, stop short of connecting Irving Park to the Red Line, stop short of connecting Garfield Boulevard to Museum of Science and Industry. Can you explain why?
Yes. Narrowness. In all three of those examples, and it pains me because I have lived for 9 years feet from Garfield Boulevard. The section of Garfield or the section of Irving Park to the Red Line or Garfield to the museum was simply too narrow for what we considered sufficient width to have the right of way for these dedicated lanes. We really were prioritizing having these dedicated lanes as a hallmark of what we consider full-blown BRT here. So the section of Garfield west of Western to Midway, if you've driven it, you know it gets a lot narrower. It's just a couple lanes of traffic and some parking. It's quite narrow. So in a few other situations, there were corridors that actually were wide enough and actually scored pretty well in terms of our livability, but we also have this connectivity to transit goal, and there just was no CTA station or Metra station there, and so we took it out of a initial network, a priority network, because it didn't meet connectivity, livability, and transit performance goals.
Thank you. Commissioner Klein, I'll throw this one at you. even though you're still relatively new to Chicago. You're probably already aware of our State Street pedestrian mall experiment, and there were buses only allowed on that street.
Yes.
It was determined not to be a successful effort. Why is this going to be any different?
Well, I've only heard about it. I wasn't here to see it, but what I have heard is that it wasn't very attractive. It was a big sort of, it was more of a bus depot in the middle of the street, sort of blah in color. It wasn't activated public space. We're actually working with State Street and the Chicago Loop Alliance right now on plans for next year to really activate the space, pop-up cafes and various other things that they were gonna do. And I think the East-West BRT is going to basically just take advantage of some of the excess space and reallocate it to a more productive use, a more economically responsible use.
So we'll have a different approach and it will be better.
Well, yeah, I think every bit of space should be activated unless it's park space.
Right, thank you. Annie, are there BRT systems in other climates like Chicago? How do they fare in the winter, i.e. snow, snow removal, snow plowing? Here's three questions for Annie. How is emergency response impacted by a lack of a left turn lane? Does that cut some kind of connectivity off? And then how do BRT systems compare in terms of emissions and energy use to light rail and heavy rail?
Okay. The first question was about climate similar to Chicago, and I would say the Cleveland Healthline would be a pretty similar climate. They have snow removal. I don't know the details of it, but it works. And then the next question was with regards to the left turns. The prohibition of left turns doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be no way to get through. So in an emergency situation, it can still be possible to allow emergency vehicles through. But in any place where you prohibit left turns, emergency vehicles may still make that left. Did I miss something?
Energy and emissions.
Energy and emissions. Well, to a degree, it depends where your power is coming from. I know that, for example, in Washington, D.C., the power is coming from coal, so which is actually dirtier than with buses. At the same time, buses, the technology for buses has gotten a lot better, and so buses have gotten a lot cleaner. And the impact of taking so many cars off of the road and replacing them with one bus that has maybe clean diesel is still better than if you didn't do that at all.
Okay, thank you, Annie. I
think the benefit of a place like Cleveland, their dedicated lane is not separated by any sort of concrete barrier or anything. So when it comes to snow removal, it's just another lane on the street as opposed to having to get into some sort of concrete channel and get snow out of there.
Well, it'll be Gabe's problem when it's snow.
It's not me.
We'll answer that in February. We'll answer that question. Mayor Peñalosa, in many instances, BRT has been proposed as a preliminary step before an investment in heavy rail. Do you have any plans to convert Transmilenio to heavy rail? Do you think that's a good idea?
Look, in Bogota, as in most places in the world, people think rail is very sexy. And so many, especially many upper-income people, the upper-middle classes, they really want the subway. In most cases, they have not the slightest intention of ever getting into the subway. But they think they will put the lower-income people underground so they will have more space for their cars. I believe the democratic and efficient thing to do is to fully use the road infrastructure that you have in order to use to put BRT. And it's very likely that afterwards you will still need more and you will need rail. In a big city like Bogota, you will need, I mean, of course, to have subway is wonderful, to have, as Gabe said, to have everything. It's just a matter what things you do. I do not say in order to replace BRT, not because BRT can basically do, as I mentioned, practically the same thing in terms of capacity and speed and everything, but at some point it may not be enough for all the roads that there are. So you will need still, and we will most likely, most surely will need a few subway lines in some corridors because the BRT will not be enough. Not to replace it, but additional to it.
Great, thank you. Commissioner, perhaps you'd want to take a stab at this. How important or integral is it to have the open fare system that the CTA is pursuing right now in order to make BRT work?
It's actually not necessary at all in that we can put kiosks or something as simple as a parking meter that can sell tickets in the bus shelter. But I do think that everything's moving towards a more virtual technology. And so I was very happy to hear that CTA was already four-fifths down the road in this direction, because you should be able to just pay with your phone or a thumbprint or a wave of a card as you walk on the bus, or it should just pick it up as you walk through, as it does when I enter the parking garage and you have your little device. It's amazing. It just knows you're there. So I think that's going to change dramatically over the next 12 months before we would launch.
Only the FBI has my thumbprint, and I want to keep it that way. Okay. Commissioner, MPC's study, and as Josh just suggested, there are a number of corridors that aren't wide enough for true BRT. Do you think there's any possibility or plans to make some streets wider so we can continue the network to some of those key destinations?
Yeah, I think it's possible. We were just talking offline here, the mayor and I, about Lakeshore Drive and also the high-speed connection to the airport, which I've been in a lot of meetings about lately. Perhaps this would be faster than a multi-billion-dollar investment. So I think there are a lot of opportunities there. In terms of widening roads, it's going to be hard to do in the city, in the city limits, because of the land use already. And I don't know if it's necessary. I think we find the same issue with our bike facilities. We're trying to put protected bike lanes in, and sometimes a road narrows, and you have to go to a shared lane for a block. If it's more than a few blocks, then it becomes a problem.
Becomes challenging. All right. We're headed up on the 2 o'clock hour. I'm going to ask every panelist just to give a quick response to a final question, and in any order, whoever feels like going first. What can we do locally to get people to stop loving their cars, to get them to share the street, and to move BRT forward? Let's go in order, Gabe.
Okay, sure. I'm a talkative guy. I think, and I meant to mention this when I was up there, I think fundamentally the future is in sharing. The idea of owning your own transportation is an outmoded idea, no pun intended. I mean, whether it's sharing a car sharing, or it's bike sharing, or sharing a bus or rail, that's the future. And I think it's going to take a bit of a cultural shift. The Europeans and folks in South America inherently, intuitively sort of get that. But I think government needs to lead by example. And when we allocate space for pedestrians, for cyclists, for transit, it sends a clear message to the public that this is something that the powers that be are bought into, and it's real. And so I think we need to lead, even if it's with small reallocations of space, and that's something that I'm trying to do. And I think we also need to be very fiscally responsible. I think it's wonderful that the Transmillennio is paying for itself. Bike sharing in DC is throwing off a 15% operating profit. And I think we should be prioritizing investments that show that they're more fiscally responsible over the long haul.
Well, it seems that when societies become very, very wealthy, cars begin to lose, at least for a few, part of their sex appeal, such as in Germany, when everybody rides a BMW and thinks so many people now. It's not so much of a status thing to go on a car, and then people will have the car, but they are more likely to use bicycles and other transport means. So I think something that we must also have clear is that traffic will not be solved by highways. It will neither be solved by highways nor by transit. Even London, with all this transit, they had to use congestion charging. So the only way to alleviate traffic is to restrict car use. And the best way to restrict car use, there are many possible ways, congestion charging or things like this, but the most obvious one is to reduce parking spaces. In many cities, there are limits, even to creating parking spaces, even in private buildings, such as the giant office development in London, Canary Wharf, which practically has no parking, only a few for people who are on wheelchairs or things like this. So I think it's basically an education problem, which has to do, as any education process, I think, a little bit with carrot and the stick. The stick, you have to make it more difficult or more expensive to use the car, and at the same time, you have to improve a lot the quality of public transport, make it better, cheaper, and also if you can do improve also public pedestrian spaces and things like this.
In terms of moving BRT forward in the city, I think the point that I tried to make at the end that, let's say Western and Ashland are the immediate priorities because of the study that's going on, we need to know from block to block, from segment to segment, from ward to ward, what those people there, what those businesses want that corridor to be. Every chamber of commerce, every merchants association, homeowner groups, businesses, schools, libraries need to come to the table and say, yes, BRT can be part of our vision, but here's our vision. That needs to happen in a coordinated fashion to educate people about the possibilities of BRT, where it fits into making the communities that they want, and then figure out after the fact what needs to happen in terms of incentives or regulatory change or land use to make it happen. But it's going to be a community planning effort at the same time as a transit planning effort.
I would add that it's also a bit of a chicken and egg problem because, yes, in order to really get people to start looking at other modes and taking other modes, you need to actually build these other modes and make an efficient system. But how do you make that efficient system without having buy-in from the public? It's really difficult. So I think there's a real power to demonstration projects, having doing a small piece in a really high-profile area and showing everybody what can be done and then spreading out from there once people really see the power of what you've done.
All right. Well, another round of applause for our entire panel. Particular thanks. Particular thanks to Mayor Peñalosa and Annie Weinstock for traveling to be with us here today. I'd also like to give a thanks to the Union League Club for hosting us today. Wonderful lunch. I always enjoy dining here. Thank you, Dave. On the tables are announcements of a couple other MPCs events coming up on September 15th. Please take a look at those and read them. One's focused on water and others on tax increment financing. We encourage you all to read the report. There's some discussions taking place online on our Facebook page. You can comment on articles on our website, and we definitely want to stay engaged with you as this continues. Thank you very much for coming today.